I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. After hinting about it, SEPTA went to court this afternoon to seek to end the strike by Transport Workers Union 234. Spokesperson Carla Shao Lee issued a brief statement on behalf of the transit agency.
SEPTA today filed a lawsuit in the Court of Common Pleas seeking an injunction to end the TWU Local 234 strike, asserting that it constitutes a clear and present danger to the health, safety, and welfare of our riders and the citizens of Philadelphia and the region.
Shao Lee says kids are missing school, patients are missing medical appointments, and voters could miss out on casting ballots for president if the strike doesn't end soon. She says the filing asks for an immediate back-to-work order, even though SEPTA had before said that it would seek an injunction to avoid the strike continuing into Election Day.
It's beyond the election. It's beyond the election. It's bigger than that. There's too many things at stake right now, and we have to come to some type of agreement.
In the filing, SEPTA cited precedent in a judge ordering striking transit workers in Pittsburgh back to work in 1992. In reaction, a spokesperson for the striking union TWU 234 asked, quote, "Why don't they just work on a settlement?" The judge has yet to rule on the request for an injunction. And as the SEPTA transit strike leaves thousands of commuters in Philadelphia stranded, there's one group that sees the picketers as a goldmine: taxi and Uber drivers, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Cruising around Old City during rush hour, taxi driver Baba Tunde expresses his mood.
I'm very, very happy. I want this strike to be continued.
That's because no subways, buses, or trolleys means more business for Tunde. How much more does that mean each shift?
Strike was started. I'm making like $300.
And how does that compare to a non-strike?
When there's no strike, yeah. I'm making $100, $120.
Part of that, he says, has to do with all the traffic from more cars on the road. The longer he and a passenger sit in a taxi, the more money he makes. The same is true for Uber drivers. During high demand times, Uber passengers are charged more per trip. That's been happening a lot more often during the strike.
Hello?
Good morning. How you doing? It's your Uber driver. I'm here. I'm going to park on the right in front of the Park 8 on 8th parking lot.
That's Uber driver Chris Kevins about to pick up passenger Khalil Craig near the convention center.
Everybody got somewhere to be.
Craig's from North Philly and came to Center City to run some afternoon errands, knowing her usual bus wasn't available.
Like, you can't stop what you're doing just because transportation is cut off. You still got to keep pushing. You got to let them know, we don't need you. We're going to find a way to do what we got to do.
The Uber driver, Kevins, says it's a case of basic economics.
It's about the demand. Everybody wants rides because everybody has to get to work, school, and events on the weekend and things like that. So they need reliable transportation.
Both Uber and Lyft reported that since the strike started midnight on Monday, ridership has been up 50%, and they no longer have to look over their backs for the PPA coming after them. That's because today in Harrisburg, Governor Tom Wolf signed a law legalizing ride-sharing across the state.
And I want to thank the legislature for working with me to finally pass, a long-term solution that will allow ride-sharing companies like Uber, like Lyft, to operate everywhere in Pennsylvania.
And as long as SEPTA management and its workers remain at a stalemate over a new contract, they both will be running a very lucrative operation in Philadelphia. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Two former allies of Republican Governor Chris Christie were convicted today of shutting down lanes to the George Washington Bridge in 2013 in a plot to punish Fort Lee Mayor Mark Sokolich for not endorsing him. Let's get the latest from WHYY's Joe Hernandez. Good evening, Joe.
Hey, Dave.
I understand the two defendants were found guilty on all charges.
All charges, 7 counts each of crimes including conspiracy, wire fraud, civil rights violations, and misapplying the resources of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Now, when the verdict was read, Bridget Kelly was sobbing. She had her hand on her face and over her mouth. Bill Baroni looked surprised, although he was smiling afterwards and hugging his family. Although when he came outside after the verdict was read, he once again told reporters that he was blameless in this whole scheme.
I am innocent of these charges, and I am very, very looking forward to this appeal.
Nonetheless, prosecutors must be pretty pleased at the verdict that was returned today.
Yeah, prosecutors were pleased, Dave, and they also addressed reporters. U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman came before reporters outside the courthouse and said today was a victory, that guilty on all counts showed that these two people, two former allies of Governor Christie, were guilty. And Fishman said cases like this are important because it shows that public officials can't abuse the public trust and can't abuse their power like this because the offices of law enforcement will hold them accountable.
When high-ranking people in government use their positions for personal or political advantage in a way that is against the law, I think it lends credence to the cynical notion that people have that people in government can't and shouldn't be trusted.
Joe, what if the verdict is upheld, what is the range of sentences that are applicable?
Some of the crimes carry a punishment of up to 20 years in prison. Now, there's another player in this, David Wildstein, who was also a member of the Port Authority. He pleaded guilty, and U.S. Attorney Fishman said his sentence will be about 2 years, give or take some months. And Fishman also said that the sentences, he'll recommend the sentences for these two defendants be harsher than that. But whether they get 20 years in prison or not, it's unclear, but it seems unlikely.
There's another player, Governor Chris Christie, who was implicated by Wildstein, Kelly, and Barone about whether he indeed knew or did not know about this plot in real time. Christie, in response, said today, quote, "I'll set the record straight in the coming days regarding the lies that were told by the media and in the courtroom." And Joe, I understand there's already a response waiting from some New Jersey lawmakers.
Right, Dave. So Christie hasn't been in this trial. I mean, he wasn't called as a witness. He wasn't charged with any crime, but he came up almost every day. And throughout the course of the trial, he's issued statements responding to some witness testimony saying, you know, I've said all along, I'm not guilty. I didn't know about these lane closures, and anything to the contrary is false. Now, that hasn't quelled the appetite in the state legislature for further investigation into Bridgegate. Assemblyman John Wisniewski and Senator Loretta Weinberg, who were both kind of active in the investigation into Bridgegate before, said today that they would be interested in opening up the investigation again because it was on hold during the case, to see what Christie knew, when he knew it, and whether any of these witnesses were correct.
Joe, do you get the sense that there is much of an appetite either from New Jersey lawmakers or the public in New Jersey to pursue this further with Chris Christie?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I hear different things from different people. Some people say, look how corrupt this administration is. And other people say, why are you spending your time following this case? But from lawmakers, there does seem to be an appetite, at least from many Democrats in the legislature, including that investigation. But also, there have been stories that some Democratic lawmakers are thinking about impeaching Christie and what impeachment would mean. That's never been done before in New Jersey, so it's not clear how that would kind of roll out. Also, there was a misconduct complaint filed against the governor by a private citizen, so Christie will have to appear in court and answer for that as well.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez on NewsWorks Tonight. When considering the conversations around Tuesday's election, climate change is not a hot topic. But there are big differences in how the presidential candidates and the Pennsylvania U.S. Senate candidates stand on the issue. Hillary Clinton supports efforts to reduce carbon emissions. Donald Trump has promised to scrap international treaties on climate change. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on an effort trying to use climate to drive young voters to the polls.
At a former yoga studio at the edge of Temple University's campus in North Philadelphia, a group of students sit on thrift store couches, hunched over computers, clicking away. Bikes are stashed against the wall. Cereal boxes and bottles of seltzer water are piled up on tables along with clipboards and campaign literature. There are even showers for the volunteers and staff who never leave.
We spend most of our lives here, so it's kind of cool. And then you come into here, which is texting area. We have materials for our folks in the field.
Patrick Milham is the state director of NextGen Climate PA, and he's showing me around the state field office of a national group spending $25 million across the country to convince young people to support Hillary Clinton. Or, more accurately, to make sure they vote against Donald Trump.
We have an app we use to text millennials and urge them to vote. And we go through and have conversations with thousands upon thousands of people every single day.
This is where thousands of texts are getting sent to young voters across the important swing state of Pennsylvania. Next Gen Climate has a presence in about 90 college campuses across the state and a paid staff of 200 people. Many were diehard Bernie Sanders supporters in the primary, including Kim Selig from Delaware County, who took a semester off to head up this social media get-out-the-vote drive.
If people are, like, in between classes, you'll be texting people and, like, they can reply, like, quickly, like, oh, yeah, of course I'm voting against Trump. And, of course, yeah, obviously election day is November 8th. Thanks for that reminder, though. It's a lot easier to get a quick reply from that versus trying to call people on the phone.
And it's not just the presidential race. NextGen spent almost $300,000 just in the last 2 weeks to get out the vote for Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Katie McGinty as she tries to beat incumbent Republican Pat Toomey. The group is officially nonpartisan, but in this election, it's only working on behalf of Democrats. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's 6:15. NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Answer, 85. Question, how many hours until balloting begins? More answers to questions with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, apparently more than 8 in 10 voters say the campaign has left them repulsed rather than excited. That comes from a New York Times CBS News poll out today. And if that's the case, I suppose they'll be excited when this campaign finally comes to a close.
I think they will. We have some different measures. One of them is negativity. We've been asking for every election cycle since 2000, or most of them at any rate. How would you describe the overall tone of the presidential campaign? Would you say it's mostly positive, mostly negative, about the middle, and so forth? Well, the percent this year who say it's mostly negative is 59%. In 08, that was 26%. In 04, it was 23%. And in 2000, it was only 3% who said it was very negative. So in all of our history, this is perceived by the public the most negative campaign we have ever seen. And in particular, people are down on Donald Trump's campaign. We said, are you satisfied with the way Clinton's run her campaign? Are you satisfied with the way Trump has run his campaign? 50% satisfied with Clinton, 29% with Trump, and that 29% for Trump is the lowest we've seen for any rating of any campaign going back to 2000.
And we've been talking for a while about the favorables for Clinton and Trump, also, I presume, at an all-time low.
They are. Trump hovering about 33% have a favorable opinion. Clinton hovering at about 42% having a favorable opinion. And do the math, that means well over half of Americans are unfavorable about both of those candidates. And that's the highest we've seen based on a couple of different measures we have here in Gallup for any candidate we've measured.
But that term hovering implies stability. And hasn't the needle moved at all relative to the October surprises that have come out of late?
We thought it might, so we were in the field just this week, Dave. These are data that we completed interviewing on Wednesday and Thursday night. So we just finished last night, as a matter of fact. We re-asked the same question. Is Hillary Clinton honest and trustworthy? And is Donald Trump honest and trustworthy? And we said, aha, we'll compare these right now to what we measured, same question, back in September. And, drum roll here, no change, which implies that most Americans' perceptions of these two candidates are baked in now, so to speak, and very unlikely to change.
Of course, the effort continues in the waning hours to get out the vote. And I believe at the same time, there's an effort to quell the vote of the opposite party.
Well, those kind of allegations fly back and forth. 66%, that's our number from just a week ago, Dave, said they are confident that the votes will be counted accurately in the U.S. And that's actually up some from when we last measured it last summer. So that's fairly high. So we don't see a big concern on the part of the average American that there's going to be irregularity in counting votes. However, I should say Republicans are significantly more likely to say there's going to be problems than Democrats. And we have a different question that we've asked all around the world. Are you confident in the honesty of elections? Three words, honesty of elections. We updated that in the U.S. this summer, and that's down 10 points. Only 30% say yes. That had been right in the 40% range in previous years. I think one of the reasons that that's lower than confidence that the votes are going to be counted is when we say honesty of elections, people think about the candidates themselves, and Trump and Clinton get very low ratings on honesty, and also think about campaign financing. Citizens United, all those types of things. So the overall process of the elections gets quite low ratings. But when it comes to actually counting the votes, as I've said, that does pretty well as far as Americans are concerned.
I'm wondering if it's also consonant with a trend you've brought up repeatedly, that being diminished faith in almost all institutions.
That's a very good point. One of the reasons that measure may be down, that is, quote, honesty of elections, is that Americans are just less confident in anything relating to the government these days. And in fact, overall, Americans' confidence in a lot of institutions in the United States are down from where they have been in previous years.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Starting tomorrow and running through next weekend, visitors to Independence Mall in Philadelphia will leave the comfort of their homes to take in an exhibit conveying the lives of refugees forced from home. Let's look at the program with Dr. Africa Stewart, who joins me now. Doctor, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is a Doctors Without Borders program, and I'm going to let you have at it the formal French name.
Oh, yes, we are a French organization. So in French, our name is Médecins Sans Frontières, which is MSF.
Which is Doctors Without Borders.
Exactly. It sounds a lot cooler than DWBs.
It sure is.
Yeah.
The Center for High Impact Philanthropy, based at Penn here in Philadelphia, cites Doctors Without Borders as being one of the esteemed institutions in terms of getting bang for the buck. Is the exhibit here intended in part as a call to action for those attending, either in terms of devoting time, services, or money?
No. I would, instead of a call of action, I would think of it more as us bearing witness, sort of answering that voice that says, if you see something, you say something. And when we're in the field and we're having these conversations amongst ourselves and field workers, part of the responsibility is when you come home, we also continue these conversations. So that conversation got really loud recently because we were talking about the refugee experience and how we were going to address it. And more of us were coming back having the same conversation. So we decided we wanted to do something that would allow us to bear witness. We wanted to make sure that we came home and did as much at home for the people in need as we do in the field.
What's your specific role or task starting tomorrow?
I will be a tour guide. So from beginning to the end of the tour, which is about an hour, we will go from station to station, talk about what makes people leave their homes, when they make that decision and how they go about it, and the distances involved and the legal issues. And then we'll also talk and bring it all in because the medical needs mirror the circumstances on the road. So we'll see chemical burns for people whose boat tipped over because the gas floats to the top. And as they're waiting for rescue, there's very particular burns that people get. So that's part of what we're doing in the field, is addressing the hypothermia for folks who are in the water, or malaria for people who have been hiding in the bush, sort of trying to get from one place to another, dehydration and certainly malnutrition, especially with the children as they're traveling.
Cite a specific example.
So this was first mission. I landed and I had never been across the Atlantic Ocean. So this was all, you know, very new and exciting. And we were taken immediately to the hospital and sort of meeting the staff and how are you? And
Where did you
this
land?
Is in Awil, Sudan. So the northern part of South Sudan, 2 or 3 days walk from what would become the border. So we had a patient who had been seen by one of the midwives a day or so before. She thought there was something going on. She wanted me to see the patient. But they had walked for a very long time. They had come from the other side of what would be the international border. The issue with leaving their land is that they had another child that had died. So that child was buried on this land. So they're not sure if they'll ever get back. So, you know, I examined her and the baby has an anomaly that's not compatible with life. So, you know, having to deliver bad news is part of what I do. And I never look forward to it, but I do feel that it needs to be done right. And I'm the one who has to do it. So it's part of the job and I accept it. But it's hard to do through a translator without the inflections of your native language and sort of what I'm used to doing with an American patient. And her face looks calm. And she's nodding and, you know, they're going back and forth and it seems, and she looked right at me and smiled. And I figured, of course, that the translator is not translating, right? So I say to him, what did you say to her? Like, I'm a little upset because this is hard and, you know, I'm upset that it hasn't been done correctly. So he relays exactly what I said to him. And that's what he said. So what, you know, there's a disconnect here. What does this mean? What I wasn't understanding is that they were so glad to be on free soil that they thought that the idea of this baby being born in a free country and even buried in free soil was worth all that they left. That for them was the most that they could offer any of their children. And it just never occurred to me that when this is all over, our child will be buried in peace. It meant the world to them. And it meant maybe never going home, never going back to a family plot, and, you know, sort of losing the cattle and all of the equivalent of wealth that they had, you know, built up and saved up for all of their lives. They're going to make a new life here, but this life will be peaceful and it'll be free and it will be worth it. And that was the beginning of realizing that I knew nothing, that I had been training and I had thought I was just so smart and connected with my patients. And it turns out I've lived a life that is full of assumptions and never, ever thought where I would bury my children.
Dr. Stewart, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Dr. Africa Stewart of Doctors Without Borders, a.k.a.
Médecins Sans Frontières.
And Forced From Home exhibit gets underway tomorrow on Independence Mall. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. This disclosure, Doctors Without Borders supports WHYY. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. Zandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. Thank you.